and start. I hope everybody now has the prayer things.
All right. So first, well, let's go back to, we had sort of gone into a meditative, you know, physical and mental posture, and now we'll renew that if we need to, just making sure that our body is straight. You can remember all the posture points if you know them. And that our body is relaxed. And bringing our attention from our thoughts and emotions, whatever is going through our minds, which we tend to be very focused on from moment to moment, just letting our attention settle into awareness of our entire body. What it feels like. What it feels like to be in our body. And what it feels like to be in our body wherever we are at this moment, in this present moment of awareness, just settling into open awareness of the present moment. Letting everything settle. And whatever arises in the mind, we just settle into awareness of that. And within this open awareness, we briefly contemplate the four reminders, which is good if we can do every day and even at the beginning of every session of study or practice, just to remind ourselves of why we need to practice. So first, remembering the precious human existence, appreciating this great opportunity that we have, this unique and very difficult to find opportunity that we have to wake up in this lifetime. Again, really feeling that appreciation. And thinking that we need to make use of it while we have it. And then remembering impermanence and death, which is a reinforcement of the need to actually practice, because the opportunity can end at any time. Through death, which is always unpredictable, through any change in circumstances, through something coming up that prevents us from practicing on a particular day as we had planned. So when we have the chance, we need to use it. And that means right now. And then third, the law of karma, cause and effect, taught by the Buddha, that what happens to us in the future, whether we are unhappy, whether we are happy, whether we are liberated from samsara, it all depends on what we do in this lifetime, in this moment. In every moment, we're creating our future, our own future. So we need to pay attention to what we're doing and do things that take us in the direction that we want to go in. And then fourth, the suffering of samsara, reminding ourselves that all of our experiences in samsara contain suffering. There is no situation in samsara, no matter how much money we have, no matter how great our relationships or our job, there's no situation that guarantees us happiness, and especially lasting happiness. So we need to not just think of freeing ourselves from unpleasant or difficult circumstances. We need to think of freeing ourselves from the whole thing, the whole samsaric state of mind. Always chasing after what we don't have and trying to escape what we do have. And then just touching upon a guru yoga, we can think of a teacher, we can think of the Buddha, whatever works best for us, on the crown of our head. I think that they are there to bless us. We're requesting their blessing to empower our practice of this meditation. And then we think that they descend into our heart center. And they remain there. They're always there. But we don't need to focus on it. We have received the blessing, and that empowers our practice. And then we go back to just calm abiding meditation to set the stage for a deeper meditation on the nature of mind. So first we just relax again into our straight posture and bring the mind to rest in the present moment by following our breath. And again, a reminder that following the breath doesn't take all of our attention, just a small part of it. We just don't want to lose track of it. So most of our attention can still remain in open awareness, just following our in-breaths and out-breaths. And then within this state of calm abiding, of having a focused but relaxed mind, we look at all experience as a dream. We just take a moment to let ourselves rest as if what we're experiencing internally and externally might be a dream we're going to wake up from. Nothing solid, nothing that can really hurt us or affect us, but just a dream. Just letting the solidity of our experience fade a bit. Become more pliable, more workable, something we can wake up from. We might have to do it again and again, just letting go of that feeling of solidity of our thoughts, of our perceptions and so forth, of even the idea that we're sitting here in meditation, that there's any I to sit here in meditation or any such thing as meditation really. And then in the second step, we turn our attention to look at the one who is experiencing our experience as a dream, our own mind, our own awareness, which is unborn. And just take a moment to see if there's anything that we can say or ascertain about what this mind is, whether it fits into any kind of conceptual category. Does it have a location? Does it have a color? Does it have any characteristics we can put our finger on? And just, it's a looking process, not an analysis process, just looking to see if we see anything. And as soon as we've looked, then we just let go of that and we rest. And that is the third step, let even the remedy release naturally. So whatever we asked, whatever we looked at, whatever determination we made, we now let go of that conceptuality, of all conceptuality, and rest in the essence, the basis of everything, the nature of mind. Not trying to do anything, not trying to have any particular kind of experience, just being in the present moment, aware of how things are, however they may be. Even again, backing off from the feeling that there's anyone doing this. And just refreshing it as needed. Our mind may wander, we may lose our sharpness, or we may lose our relaxation. We just adjust continually as we become aware that we've strayed a little bit from simply resting in how things are. This is what is meant by the instruction, short sessions. Many sessions. It doesn't mean you get up and down but that you can sit for as long as you want to, and you just keep refreshing it as you need to. You lose it, then you find it again, whatever it is. Just patiently, not trying to maintain something, but just refreshing it as needed. Really giving your mind all the rope it needs to be relaxed and alert and open. And within the state of being in touch with the nature of mind, whether we feel we recognized it or not, is of no, it doesn't matter, no concern. So just whatever state that is that we've been resting in, within that, without losing touch with that, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So let's start off the way that Pema Chodron does. We mix it up from week to week. The way Pema Chodron teaches this in Start Where You Are is to first focus on the breath. We'll come back to just really being continuously aware as we breathe in, as we pause if we do, as we breathe out. And then we can add a texture to that. No thoughts, no visualization, just a texture. The dark, heavy texture we breathe in. The light, refreshing texture we breathe out. And that dark, heavy texture that we're breathing in, as we breathe it in, we let it dissolve just as our breath dissolves into our vast Buddha nature. And now we're going to attach those textures to taking and sending. We can start by just, as Ramanarla Rinpoche has taught it, start with the vast concept of breathing in all the suffering that there is of all sentient beings as hot, heavy texture or light. Letting it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature. And breathing out happiness, peace, healing, whatever's needed to all sentient beings. As Trungpa Rinpoche says, breathing in everything unpleasant, whatever it may be. People suffering, pollution, pain. And breathing out everything good. Breathing in everything bad, breathing out everything good. It's called mind training because this is not what we naturally do. And now we're going to attach this taking and sending to a specific situation, which is the situation in the verse that we're studying, if we can bring to mind, and if you can't, just bring to mind some other situation and some other verse that resonates with you. But was there a time when someone undercut you in a situation where it was really humiliating? You had a great idea and somebody made fun of it, or you had a fault, harking back to one of the previous verses, verse 15, that someone exposed. And we're going to breathe in what that feels like. The feeling of humiliation. And breathing out to ourselves the antidote to those feelings. Relaxation, peace, not caring. Breathing in the unpleasant feeling of humiliation. Breathing out whatever it takes to feel fine about it. Bringing really vividly to mind whatever the situation was and how we felt about it, and breathing that in. Letting it dissolve and breathing out relief. Thinking that we're not the only one who was ever humiliated in that way, or whoever experienced that emotion. Breathing in the humiliation of every sentient being. Letting it dissolve and breathing out healing and peace and relaxation and happiness. And you can keep those textures if they're helpful, the hot, heavy texture breathing in, the light, refreshing texture breathing out, or not. And then knowing that all sentient beings, there's probably not a single being who has never experienced being one-upped, being undercut, being exposed, being humiliated. So we're really breathing in the suffering of all sentient beings. And breathing out the opposite. And now really thinking that it's working and that we are taking away the suffering of ourselves and all sentient beings by breathing it in and letting it dissolve. And really filling ourselves and all sentient beings with happiness and peace and healing. We think that we and all sentient beings throughout the entire universe in all the six realms, we're all free from suffering. We're all filled with happiness, and we're all completely awakened, and we'll rest in the joyful feeling. And then letting that feeling dissolve along with all thoughts and concepts, we'll come back to either following our breath or resting in open awareness, whatever's more comfortable. Just resting again, just as in the last step of the ultimate bodhicitta meditation. And we'll come back now to the present moment and readiness to resume our study and contemplation. Then take a few breaths, do some stretching, whatever you need to do. Think a few thoughts to get your mind moving. Does anybody have any questions or anything they'd like to say before we do the verses? Sally, I'm going to unmute you.
It's hard to not take, maybe get a little bit superior because you think, okay, well, I'm one of these like earned people that can be here with you and have the Buddha. And like, it's hard to disassociate that with from some kind of like pride.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's coming in verse 19. But yeah, that's one of the things to look out for. Like at the very beginning of morning tsokpa at the monastery and throughout the Kagyu world and probably the Tibetan Buddhist world, the very first prayer that we do at the beginning of morning tsokpa every day, one of the main components of it is not to be arrogant. Like not to think we're better than other people, not to think because we have this opportunity, not to let it go to our head, so to speak. We have to renew that every day because it's such a habitual thing. So we just work with that, Valerie. It's like it's not that there's something wrong with us or that we're not practicing properly if we feel that. It's just that when we catch ourselves feeling that, we let go of it. And it's that simple. You know, any kind of, because pride is one of the poisons, one of the mental poisons. Whenever we feel a mental poison arising, we don't judge ourselves for it. It's not that there's something wrong with us. Everybody has this. Even I'm sure many of our teachers have these things arise. I think once you reach a certain level of practice, maybe you catch it even before it arises. But the point is that when it arises, we recognize that it's arisen and then we apply the remedy, which is to turn it into taking and sending or to just look directly at it and let the mind rest in its essence. So it's good when these things arise, and what's even better is when we recognize it and you're recognizing it. So that's the whole point of what we're doing here, of our practice, to know that these things are happening in our mind. And then to have some idea of what to do about that. So anything further?
No, thank you.
Okay, yes. Good work, Valerie. Anybody else? All right, then we'll go to the verses. I will go to screen sharing and we'll chant the verses together. Okay. First, the seven preliminary verses, which are ongoing practices. It's not like we did them and they're done. These are ongoing practices and we're refreshing our reminder and our resolve to engage in them constantly in our lives. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. It's not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So those were the preliminaries, and now the three levels of motivation, of which we need all three. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. This is the highest level of motivation for practice. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning, cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Now taking and sending. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Now we enter bodhisattva boot camp, which we are almost at the end of now. Specific situations where we apply taking and sending. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Last week's verse. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And this week's verse we'll chant three times, really feeling it as much as we can because we've all been in this situation. If someone, my inferior or peer, through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher, and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone, my inferior or peer, through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher, and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone, my inferior or peer, through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher, and place them reverently on my crown. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we're all back. So I wanted to share something that I heard recently from another student of another teacher about the value of memorizing. And I'm not saying, again, that we all need to memorize all these verses. I think it's a wonderful aspiration and very enriching thing to do. And as I've said before, at least on the blog, if you're only going to pick a few verses to memorize, I think Bodhisattva Boot Camp is the way to go. I mean, that's an individual situation. But if you feel like you could only hold on to, you know, a dozen or so verses, it's always good to work with the verse that we're on. But if you want to commit some to lasting memory, I think 12 through 19. Because, like, for me, I recognize those situations when they happen, thanks to having studied the verses. And having that remedy right there, you know, in my mind is really helpful. But back to what this student said. This is Cortland Dahl, who is a student of Nyingma Rinpoche. And talking about memorizing a different text or practice. He said, and I've actually sent this out before, it's one of the 10 Dharma activities. And he said something that I felt was really helpful, that it's not even necessarily about memorizing it, like having something to hold on to. It's about the use of our time in the process of memorizing or of reciting something over and over again. And one benefit of that is that we're not doing something else at that time. We're not using our time and our mental energy to engage in something negative, like ruminating about some bad situation that happened to us or how angry we are at somebody or anything like that. We're actually in the present moment devoting our mind to Dharma. So whether you end up with a memorized verse or not, the time that you spent on it in that way is extremely beneficial. So I just thought that was really helpful. That is what the 10 Dharma activities are. And I've never really thought of it in that light, that it's using our time in a positive way when we could be using it in either a negative way or just as wasted time. So all of the, I don't remember all the 10 Dharma activities, but reciting and memorizing are two of them. Oh, Dan, you want to read them to us?
Oh, no, I'm just showing you.
Yeah, the thing that we sent around, that's right, Dan's artwork that he used to memorize the.
It helps out a lot.
It's not the 10 Dharma actions, which actually I have linked on my blog in various places, mm-hmm. but that he actually made a whole project out of doing artwork and memorizing.
It's made a big difference, though, with remembering.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's easy to just pull it out and do it.
Yeah. Well, I find the knowing them is really helpful, too, but also just that time of engaging in it. That's merit. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the creation of merit, and that's what it feels like. It's a very positive feeling to be chanting the verse again and again, whether you end up with it memorized or not, which is like a side benefit if you do. So anyway, another plug for study, I guess, study and it's sort of study and contemplation. So we are on verse 17, and I don't know if everybody's had a chance to read Dingo Chinsei's commentary. He has a very short commentary this time and doesn't really cover any ground, I think, that he hasn't covered in other commentaries on these boot camp verses. We are going to look at one sentence of his commentary, and then we're going to look at a sentence related to that from Geshe Jampa Techo's commentary, and then we're going to mostly focus on Ken MacLeod's commentary this time. But I wanted to point out, if you've had a chance to read the notes, the class notes on this verse, you already know, I noticed that this is the second one of this very short set of verses where the remedy is to think of the person as your teacher, like somebody has harmed you. And with slander, you think of them as your spiritual friend. Not slander, actually, it's with pointing out your hidden faults. That's verse 15. You actually did something that you don't want people to know about, you actually did it, and it gets exposed. And so what you go to is seeing the person who exposed you as your spiritual friend. And here again with this verse, which is also like the topic of it is humiliation, according to Dingo Shinzi Rinpoche. In both cases, you're being humiliated in some way, as opposed to harmed in some other way. In both cases of humiliation, the go-to remedy is to see the person, put the person on the crown of your head, see them as your spiritual friend, see them as your benefactor. This is not a reflexive reaction, obviously. So it takes work. It might be the third or the fourth thought that we manage to think about it, or it might be the next day when we're removed enough from it that we could actually go there. But it's just, I was impressed by noticing the repetition there, and just brought up the whole thought that when what adversity does to us, whether it's like non-human cause, or you know, an act of God, or just something that happened, like our car skidded, it wasn't anybody's fault, or you know, whenever anything bad happens, especially when somebody on purpose hurts or undermines us, what the effect of that is really to pull the rug out from under us. And that's also the function of the spiritual guide, is to, at least especially the Vajrayana, to pull the rug out. Like, we think we're doing so great. In the case of verse 15, we have all these hidden faults, or maybe at least one hidden fault, and we think we're okay, like nobody needs to know about that, and otherwise we're perfectly fine, and then, you know, somebody spills the beans, and it really hurts, and it not only feels like it hurts us, but it also destroys our sense that we have any control over our lives, which is a false sense. I mean, that's what the four thoughts are about. That's mostly what, you know, impermanence and death is about. We have no control, like it could happen any moment. We have this illusion that we're sort of creating our lives as we wish them to be, to a certain extent at least. And so when something like that happens, it drives every thought of that out of our mind. And then I was thinking that, what would our lives be if we didn't have adversity? Like, so we're learning here to see adversity as a blessing, as an opportunity for practice, like for Dharma practice, an opportunity to wake ourselves up, like a blessing in that sense. But like, what would it really be like if we didn't have any adversity? And I thought, well, that would be the God's realm, right? We all have studied the six realms. The God's realm is where there's no adversity. Nothing ever goes wrong. Nobody stubs their toe in the God's realm. You know, nobody loses their job. Nobody has somebody break up with them. Nothing bad happens. And that's sort of what makes it the God's realm. So what's the problem with that? Like, why wouldn't we want that? We think we want that. But why wouldn't we want that? So that's a contemplation. But if anybody wants to speak to that, you're welcome to do it. Is that Andy? I'm going to unmute you.
Yeah.
Hey, Andy.
It gets boring.
Okay.
I mean,
let's say it doesn't, though. I mean, wouldn't it be part of the God's realm that it's not boring?
In the Dharma context, you would never like make any move to become enlightened or to do any kind of practice.
Yeah.
I think it also is, you can't have one with, you can't experience even a tiny bit of samsaric happiness we have without adversity to highlight it.
Yeah, right. Well, there is that. I don't know if that's part of the argument you're making, but I know I've heard people seven up, mute you just because I'm getting an echo. I have heard people say that they wouldn't want to not have like the lows, like the depression and the bad things, because then they wouldn't appreciate the highs if you had it all the time. So when Andy said at the beginning that it would be boring, that probably is, I mean, maybe it is in some sense. But yeah, I think the second thing that you said is getting more at what I'm thinking, which is you don't do anything. You don't, so you've used up all of your karma. I mean, this is the way the Buddha expressed it. You use up all your karma. It takes all your good karma to get to the God's realm. And then you don't do anything. Because everything's perfect, you don't do anything to create any new positive karma, any merit, or to wake yourself up
you don't care that you're in a dream because it's a really good dream. Have you ever woken up from a really good dream and gone, oh, darn. Like, why did I have to wake up to my regular life? The gods don't want to wake up from their dream. But the downside of that, so what's the problem with that? Angela, I'm going to unmute you.
I think we wouldn't be able to have compassion for other beings. We would just lose our compassion, our ability to have compassion if we weren't. So we wouldn't be able to relate to the beings we want to help free anyway.
Right.
But it really helps to connect to that pain to other people. Right. And really feel for them and help them through it. And if you don't know what it's like, you can't help them through it. You're just like, oh, I'm so sorry, but I don't understand.
I'll just go about my business. That's your problem.
You don't have any comprehension or understanding of what they're going through.
Yeah. Well, what you're getting at is like even the next thing I was going to say, which is the teaching is that the human realm is the best realm to be in, not the God's realm. You'd think it would be the God's realm because everything's perfect, but it's the human realm, and it's the human realm because it's said that we have the right mixture of suffering and happiness. You know, it's not like the hell realms or the hungry ghost realms are completely absorbed in our suffering and our negative situation. We have enough happiness to recognize what we're aiming for. And as Angela's pointing out, to be able to have compassion, and without compassion, you can't wake up. So in the God's realm, there's no hope of waking up. That. The only thing that happens is that you plunge straight to the hell realms is the teaching, because you used up all your good karma and your merit to get there, and you didn't create any new, you didn't develop wisdom and compassion. So when you realize that you're going to die, it said that's the worst suffering of the six realms, period, worse than the hell realms, is the realization of the God and the God's realm that they're about to die. They get like 10 days notice or something. You know, their armpits start smelling and things like that. There's like specific signs. And they realize what's going to happen, which is there's nowhere to go but down from here. So as humans, we're very lucky. We have adversity and we have happiness. Enough adversity to spur us to engage in practice. And enough happiness happiness, leisure, freedom. We have what we need to do it. Which they don't have apparently in like the hell and hungry ghosts and animal realms. There's no possibility. So anyway, these are the reasons why we see people who create adversity for us as our teachers, because they're spurring us to wake up. Like, where else is there to go from humiliation? But like, you have to sort of confront, to heal from humiliation, you've got to confront the reality of the situation, and that's waking up. And you confront, as Angela's bringing into the discussion, it brings up compassion for other people who have suffered the same kind of suffering. So then you would never do that to somebody else. You learn from that. You wouldn't do that to somebody else. I've learned that hardly myself. I would never do to other people, you know, some of the things that have been done to me, or vice versa. Some of the things that I've done in my childhood, in my past, I've recognized through developing more compassion that I would never do that again. So anyway, we will look at the, anybody have anything else to say before we look at the commentaries? I don't see any, Joanne, yes, I'm gonna unmute you.
Would you say adversity would be opportunities for purification?
That too.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. We've been encouraged to look at that by Dingo Chenzi in a couple of verses. He didn't put it in those exact terms, so thanks for bringing that up. That one of the first places we can go is to think this is our karma. Like, this wouldn't happen to me if I had not created this karma somewhere in the past. And so from there, like, that's just a basic recognition that takes the sting out of it a bit. But you can go that one step further that you're suggesting. Which is to realize that you're burning off that negative karma, like you're paying it off. It's purification. And if you play your cards right in that situation and don't create more negative karma, then you won't have to revisit that again. So thank you, Joanne. Anybody else have anything? Okay, Dan, you're unmuted.
Actually, moving to a lower income neighborhood was like, I mean, it just opened up my compassion so much more. I didn't realize the divide I had between people, maybe.
Yeah.
You know? And how comfortable I was, like, in the city and kind of, like, in the fan district and stuff in Richmond. So that's been really good. And it was really hard when I first moved here, actually. Kind of shocking a little bit. So
in a way, you took yourself out of the relative God's realm and put yourself into the relative human realm.
Right. And it was,
you know, more something else. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really didn't realize just how divided I was. Like, I thought I was very open to everybody, but it made a big change in my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. Anybody else have anything they would like to contribute or share? All right, then we will look at Dingo Chense Rinpoche very briefly this week, both because it's short and because, again, he's pretty much covering ground that he's covered with the other verses. I think at a certain point you run out of new things to say about Bodhisattva Boot Camp. But at the bottom of page 127, if you have the book, he says, you know, not only should we not be angry or upset or feel badly treated when somebody humiliates us, undercuts us, whatever it is that they do to us, we should pray that you may be able to do them as much good as possible. So that's really turning the tables from our instinctive reaction, perhaps. And then he says, whatever happens, do not wish for a moment to take your revenge. We don't even get a moment to contemplate revenge. But the reason I'm reading that particular sentence is because Geshe Jangpa Tegchok, and he's the Gelugpa teacher, this is translated by Thubten Shudrin, very well-known ordained practitioner in the West. He gives us a little bit of an out there, because are we really going to be able to practice like that? Like, not even a moment of anger? Really? I mean, that's what we're aiming for. That's like our ultimate goal. But if we're not there, what happens? Like, what if we do explode in the moment or say something or have a thought of revenge? Like, are we a total failure? And, you know, again, like, Tibetan Buddhism tends to speak in hyperbole a little bit. You know, it's like, oh, anyone who hears one mani will be enlightened. Well, and actually there's a lot that has to happen between that hearing that mani and actually being awakened. And, you know, don't even have a moment's thought of revenge. Well, yes, that's the advice. But as Westerners, we're kind of all or nothing. And we think if we screw up a little bit, then we're done. Like, I'll never be able to do that. And then we give up. Like, it's all over. I'll never be a bodhisattva. I'm done because I had a moment of anger. And this is something that a lot of us actually really struggle with. I mean, I'm making light of it. But we can struggle with this. So what Geshe Jangpa Tegchok says here is, so somebody's done the terrible thing to us. He says, if someone hurts us, we may get a little angry and say something in return. He's not saying it's a good thing to do, but he says it might happen. He says, this may not be the best response, but if we pretend to be patient, yet keep the anger smoldering inside of us, thinking, I will not forget what happened, I will never help her, I will get back at her for that, then we commit the great bodhisattva downfall of abandoning sentient beings. So by suppressing, you know, sort of through this false patience, through pushing down like our real emotions and not acknowledging them, it can actually lead us into a much worse transgression of actually, you know, in our cold anger, in the cold hell of our cold, vengeful anger, we could think, I will never help that person. Even if I could help them become Buddha, I never would do that. You could have that thought, and that's the one way that you break the bodhisattva vow, is to give up on sentient beings. So he goes on to say, he goes on to say, this is also the tantric root downfall of abandoning love for sentient beings. So it's like, it's a pretty serious transgression in various different ways. So we're going to come back to him, but I wanted to bring in, let's see, I put in the blog and I meant to look it up.
But I wanted to get the words more or less right. So I'm looking in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, and I'm looking in the chapter on the Paramita of Patience, which I should have bookmarked, but I didn't. And we're looking in the first kind of patience, which is being patient with someone who harms you, which is what we're talking about in Bodhisattva Boot Camp. We're in the essential characteristics of each aspect. And he says, when someone does something to harm us, what does it mean to be patient? Like, how does one go about being patient in that circumstance? What does patience involve? And he says, it means, number one, remaining unperturbed, like not being disturbed by it. That's the ultimate patience. That's what Dingo Chense Rinpoche says we should do, like not even one thought of revenge, like no anger. And that's the ultimate goal. But beyond that, also it means not retaliating against them. It also means not holding on to resentment in our mind. So that it's threefold patience. There's three aspects to it. And so we might flunk the first one, you know, because we're training. We're trainees not to be disturbed at all. That's a really high bar. And we're not going to make that one for the most part now. Not actually retaliating, we might be able to manage that. Like, you might feel really angry. You want to acknowledge that. You want to recognize, like, what your emotion is. And there's a lot of training methods to do that. You know, the first one always is just pause. What's going on in my mind? Recognize, oh, I'm feeling really angry. Just by stepping back that much, that can keep you from retaliating. And also through recognition, like if you acknowledge it and recognize it in the moment, that could keep you from holding on to resentment. So it all comes back to the same thing. We can't control our initial emotional reaction. So we don't want to take Dingo Chense Rinpoche's advice too literally. We didn't fail if we have that impulse towards anger, if we have that thought of revenge. What we want to do is intervene right there and recognize it and remedy it, take a time out if we need to, whatever we have to do to not take it any further. And we want to stay in that recognition and until it resolves itself in some way, because otherwise, if it's like simmering unresolved, it can lead us into much worse failures of bodhicitta than simply, you know, lashing out momentarily at somebody. Yes, Valerie, I'm going to unmute you. Whoops. Okay, now you're unmuted.
Is it wrong to take comfort in the fact that these people in their karma will, you know, it will work out for, you know what I'm saying?
You mean when somebody does something bad, you could say, well, karma's going to take care of that. I don't have to punish them. Yes. Well, I think we can think that. I think it's actually really helpful to think that. And it's actually one of the like nine methods that Gampopa lists in Ornament of Precious Liberation. Like when we're feeling angry at somebody, that's one of the places we can go, is that through their harming us, they are incurring negative karma that's going to cause them suffering. So thinking it is not wrong. Rejoicing in it, we probably don't want to go there if we can avoid it. Like if we find ourselves being happy that they're going to suffer in the future, we might want to, you know, apply some remedies to back off from that, because we don't want to really rejoice in anybody's suffering. But again, we can't stop our impulses. And to pretend that we don't have them, you know, I think there's a name for that, which is spiritual bypassing, is like to think that, like you're just going to be a practitioner. You're not going to have these nasty old emotions, and so you don't recognize them when they arise, or you just close them off in some way. But they stay there, just like karma. It stays there. So, back to Valerie, we can recognize that we're feeling that way. Like, oh, I feel really happy. I'm feeling really happy that this person's going to suffer in the future because they made me suffer right now. That's actually revenge. That's thinking of revenge. It's letting karma do the work for you, which is way better than doing it yourself. I mean, you're still plus plus. You know, you're not taking revenge. You're just thinking, okay, it's going to happen anyway. And so then you kind of might pull yourself back, that go back to the four immeasurables. Like, may all beings have happiness. May all beings be free from suffering. We don't want anybody to suffer. So it's a really delicate balance where we want to hold ourselves to a high standard of of practice as an aspiring bodhisattva, but we don't want to be too hard on ourselves at the same time, because it's a learning curve. It's a very long and difficult learning curve. So we could be happy no matter what. Like, we have thoughts of revenge and we could go, oh, great, I'm catching myself having thoughts of revenge, I can work on this. Instead of going, oh my God, I'm such a failure as a bodhisattva because I'm thinking of like letting the air out of this person's tires or whatever. You know, whatever revenge we might have in mind. All right, anybody else have anything on this topic? I just wanted to go back then to, very briefly, to Transforming the Heart by Geshe Dampa Kegchok and pick up where we left off. So he said, so maybe we do have a little moment of anger and maybe we do lash out a little bit, but letting off that steam might prevent something worse from happening. So we give ourselves that sort of that little bit of leeway. But he says, we also have to use it to remind ourselves that anger is not ever a useful emotion. And he says, this anger, which seems like it is protecting us, is completely self-defeating and brings us only harm. There is no use in it. We must remind ourselves of this over and over again so that it sinks in. So how these two things go together is that we don't be too hard on ourselves just because we had a little failure of bodhicitta. But we use that to contemplate the harmful effects of anger and help to train our minds, help to, you know, renew our motivation or increase our motivation to not fall into anger because it's only harmful. And there's many, many teachings on that. I actually forgot I was going to start with Kempo Sultan Jamso Rinpoche. We have not looked at him in a while. We bring him in every once in a while. I find a lot of his commentary, it's very short and it's very, very sort of traditional Tibetan, in a way that sometimes other commentaries that speak a little bit more directly to Westerners. But here I really liked some of what he had to say about verse 17. And he says, being despised is a wonderful remedy for pride. So, Valerie, to answer your initial question today, you could go find somebody to, if you're feeling proud and, you know, full of yourself about having this wonderful opportunity that other people may not have, go have, find somebody to deflate you. Being despised is a, then we can always find somebody who doesn't like us. Like to cut us down. There's like no dearth of such people in the world. Being despised is a wonderful remedy for pride. Praise has the opposite effect. Instead of deflating pride, praise inflates it. Of the two then, being despised or being praised, which benefits your Dharma practice more? Let's take a moment to contemplate that. Is it better for us to be despised and criticized, or is it better for us to be praised and built up? And then he says, and why is it that praise causes pride and blame causes frustration? Why do we enjoy praise and reject blame? So he's taking us straight into the eight worldly concerns here. And the ultimate question, like, what's the difference between being praised and being blamed? Why does one make us feel one way and the other makes us feel the other way? It's a failure of equanimity here. And the more we're caught in that, the more we're caught up in the eight worldly concerns, the more we suffer and the less progress we have made on the path. So the eight worldly concerns, I advertise those a lot. I'm a great promoter of being aware of the eight worldly concerns, and I have the little mnemonic verse on my website, which I was going to have us chant together, but I think we probably don't have time since we want to look at Ken McLeod a bit. But it's something to kind of like, be familiar with them, loss and gain. Like, why does it feel good to win, and why does it feel bad to lose? Like, what's the difference? And I think actually Dingo Chense, actually, in one of the recent commentaries on one of the recent verses, says there's really ultimately no difference between winning and losing, so why do we care? Like, in ultimate reality, there's no difference. So loss and gain, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and then disgrace or a bad reputation, and fame or a good reputation. that's something to contemplate the next time we find ourselves criticized. It's easiest when it's the negative part, because that's when we question things. When it's the positive part, like you win, or things feel really good, or you're getting praised, we don't examine our experience quite so much in those situations. But if we did, you know, it's a question of awareness. Like, okay, somebody's praising me, and you notice how you feel, and you think, what would it feel like if it were the other way around? These are really good mental exercises to do. So, and then this is the payoff here. He says, when we analyze that question with our intelligence, we discover that both pride and frustration are concepts dependent on thoughts. It's like there's no reality to them. It's just thoughts. It's just concepts. He says, once we grasp this conceptual process, once we learn to recognize the conceptual process as it's happening, then it is easy to understand emptiness. So our tormentors are helping us to understand emptiness, but only if we engage with this kind of analysis that we're being encouraged to do through all these commentaries. Yes, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you. Yes. Okay, you're unmuted.
So may I go so far as to say that equanimity is like non-duality, is like emptiness? Is that, do they seem to follow? Are they related?
Equanimity, non-duality, and emptiness. They are related. I mean, I don't think we can get into like any kind of a deep discussion of it here because we don't have a lot of time, but equanimity helps us to see emptiness. Emptiness is something we need to recognize because it's part of our basic nature. So both equanimity and non-duality is also, my screen is fading, so I have to plug in before something bad happens. So the more that we can exercise our equanimity muscle, for example, with weather and stoplights, or any other situation, by, you know, analyzing the eight worldly concerns when we find ourselves caught up in them, it helps us to see the emptiness. Like, what is the difference really between being praised and being blamed? They're just words. It's just words. Nothing's really happening. Non-duality is part of, like, our nature. So I think equanimity is a doorway to both of those, but not directly, especially with non-duality, not directly. So they're somewhat different. They're all somewhat different things that we work at through different means, but they're definitely all related.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Then we will end in our last 15 minutes or 10 minutes. With Ken McLeod's commentary, which is, you know, the last couple of verses, we haven't worked much with Ken McLeod. I really especially liked his commentary, like the whole thing this week. So if you have the book and you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend it. We're going to go through as much of it as we have time for now, especially for those who don't have Reflections on Silver River. So he says, so he starts out, and this is in my blog as the contemplation. This is the contemplation from my class notes. He likes to put us in the middle of what would this situation feel like in Western terms, like something that might happen to us here in the West. How would this play out? So he says, suppose you are part of a group working on a project. And this is definitely like a scenario, like a work situation is where this kind of thing, somebody cutting you down to build themselves up, could happen. Suppose you're part of a group working on a project. Something has gone wrong, and all of you are trying to understand what happened and what to do next. So you're kind of having a brainstorming session. People in the group come up with different ideas as to what to do. Tensions rise as competing interests come to the surface. You put forward an idea that you think will work for everyone. A colleague dismisses your suggestion with a witty comment at your expense. Let's feel the sting of that for a moment. We had this great idea. We took the risk of sharing it with everybody, and somebody just cut our legs off by making fun of it. So everybody laughs at you. You are a little stunned and say nothing. He then floats his own idea, which is only slightly different from yours. Because you have been sidelined, the group quickly supports his idea, which is really your idea. You are left looking stupid, incompetent, and out of touch. So I don't know that any of us have experienced that exact situation, but I personally can certainly relate to it. So what do we do? So what's the dynamic here is the first thing he talks about. When someone puts you down, what happens? Like, where do we go wrong right away? Anybody got an idea? What's the, like, anybody remember the capsule description of mind training? Two words that sum it up. It is others first. So what's the trap that we fall into as soon as somebody does something like this to us? We are not thinking of others first. He says, when someone puts you down, usually the person you are most concerned about is you. Life comes at you like a herd of wild horses. You may dodge one way or another to avoid being trampled. You may look for a chance to grab the mane of a horse so you can haul yourself up and ride away. Whatever you do, your main concern is you. So, what do we do about that? How do we get out of being stuck on Team I? Like, just being completely caught up in our own emotional reactivity here. He says, open to what has just happened. Someone put you down and sidelined you, and you are upset, angry, and offended. So that's it. Like, that's the crux of it. That's the thing we're always trying to do, is recognize what we're experiencing as we're experiencing it. As it's first coming up, can we see what is going on in our mind? Can we define it? Because if we can define it, we're no longer caught up in it. We're looking at it a little bit from outside. We've already got some distance on it. So you just define it. You say, okay, somebody put me down. Somebody threw me on the sidelines, out of the action, and I'm upset. I'm angry. I'm offended. Define what you're feeling. He says, your tormentor has brought out a reactive pattern in you and brought it out so vividly that you cannot ignore it. It's very hard to ignore humiliation. And it jolts you awake. That's why they're our teacher. You are attached, very attached to what people think of you and how people regard you. So this is your thought process. I'm really upset. This thing happened. I'm so upset. I'm so angry. I'm so humiliated. Oh, that means that I'm very attached to what people think of me. That somebody could just say a few words and it would just destroy my whole day, maybe my whole life. So once you see that, once you see that what you're really experiencing is attachment, one of the mental poisons, once you see that clearly, then resentment, anger, and embarrassment start to fall away. Your emotional reactivity starts to break up because you're no longer under its sway. You have separated yourself by recognizing it and putting a name to it and going, ha, it's just ego clinging. Just one of the many, many guises of ego clinging or Team I. He says, you may even laugh or sigh inside. Laugh or sigh, in case he couldn't hear that word. So sighing, when you sigh, it's like a relaxation, right? When you laugh, it's definitely, it just feels, the humor in it is huge. Like, that just destroys it right there. He says, you were caught once again. So that's your next realization is, ha, it got me again. Ego clinging got me again. Your tormentor has functioned as a teacher. So that's how the dynamic works. That's how you get from victim to reverence, you know, victim to, you know, bowing down to this person. Thank you. You've just woken me up a little bit to my own patterns, my own subjectivity. That's not the right word. Subjugation to the mental poisons. So we have a few more minutes. We'll go a little further. So if you could just remember, I would write down those steps, you know, I probably will, on an index card. That's the kind of thing I keep, like, where I can see it. You know, like, recognize what's happened, recognize how it's making you feel, recognize the mental poison that underlies you feeling that way, or the worldly concern that, and then recognize that that's like, it's just fake. It's just ego. Again, It's just your ego again trying to get what makes you feel good instead of what makes you wake up, because ego does not want us to wake up. So Ken goes on. However you feel about being put down, use that feeling for taking and sending. And that's what we did at the beginning of class. It's the answer to every single one of the bodhis. There's only one answer. Like if you have that answer, you will never fail any of the tests. Like any situation could be thrown your way and you could go, oh, A, B, C, or D. And C is taking and sending. It's always C. You could never go wrong with taking and sending. So however you feel about being put down, use that feeling for taking and sending. If you are angry, and this is beautiful. This is just pay attention to this. This is very beautifully put paragraph. If you are angry, take in the anger of others and send them whatever joy and peace of mind you have known in your life. So maybe you don't feel any joy right now, but you felt joy last week when that great thing happened. Send them that. If you are resentful, another way you could be reacting, take in others' feelings of resentment and send respect and appreciation to the person who's harming you. If you are offended, take in the pain and insult and send to the person who's harming you praise and honor. If you are confused, take in confusion, your own confusion and everybody else's confusion, and send clarity and insight. So whatever emotion we're feeling, we figure out what's the opposite of that, and we send that out. Take in the pain of being put down and send out the warmth of courtesy and encouragement, the way you wish you had been treated. So you take in the way that you're treated and you send out the way you wish you had been treated. Take in the emotional reactions that drive one person to put down another. Like what makes a person do that to another person? Just take it in. Whatever, even if you can't put it in words, like whatever it is that made that person want to humiliate me, you just breathe that in, take that in, and send out your ability to treat everyone, even your worst enemy, with kindness and respect. And Valerie, thank you for bringing up pride, because that's where you could get derailed by pride. It's like, well, I would never treat anyone that way, so therefore I'm a much better person. We're not, yes, I'm going to unmute you. Yes.
There's a kind of a pride, like when you see, like you were saying just now about that if somebody needs to do that, it speaks to, you know, their faults, right?
Yeah.
So you take, that's what you see, and you take satisfaction in that. That's a kind of a pride too.
Yeah. And that's the fine line that we're trying to be aware of. We're just trying to be aware of that so that we send them the way that we know that we are capable of treating people. We would never humiliate someone on purpose, but we do it without thinking that we're better. Maybe they have some good quality that we don't have. You know, and it just happens that this is a situation where they did something we feel we would never do. We try to do it without pride, but don't worry about it too much. You know, it's like, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. That's a saying we have. It's like, just because, you know, don't make the perfect the enemy. Right, just because you can't do it perfectly, then you don't try to do it at all. Like, so maybe you're going to have some pride. Don't worry about it. Just do the taking and sending. And know that you would never do that to somebody else. And I think you can take, pride may not be the word exactly, but I'm not sure what the word is. And we might have to use the word pride. You could take some pride in that. Like I would never, because I have had the opportunity, you know, to study the Buddhist teachings. I've developed compassion. I would just never treat another person like that. But recognize the other person's Buddha nature, if you can, at the same time. Angela, I'm unmuting you.
At the same time, I kind of always remember that I was capable and have been capable and have done that before.
Yeah.
So I always keep that, making me humble.
Yeah.
I feel bad because now I've found a way to overcome it. I want to help them do it. It puts me in a position not to think in that kind of way that I'm better, but that, oh my God, I see myself as that person and I want to help them be free from that.
Right. Yes, thank you. I would say we all have that. We can look back and see things we've done. And actually, you know, how long can you maintain that pride before you do the next thing that you're not proud of? I mean, my day is totally self-correcting. I could never have too much pride because five minutes from now, I'm going to do something. And you know, I think somebody in 3-year retreat once, it wasn't my retreat, but this is like a legend that passed down from retreat to retreat. I think this is the person, it was Sasha Strelka in her retreat, which I think was the fourth retreat, said, you know, as soon as you have a critical thought about another person, you make the same mistake, like immediately. And I think there's some truth to that. Like, don't you, if you think that person's chanting, like they just stumbled in their chanting and you're kind of going, ha, 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 well, that distracts you enough that you now screw up your chanting and somebody else is laughing at you. So so thank you, everybody. We have just a couple of minutes. I'm going to see if we can read a little bit more of this. So that was the taking and sending. Whatever emotion you have, you can take that in and send out the opposite of it to the other person. And he says, from there, it is more possible to disengage from the game playing and one-upmanship that are so common in life, to treat your assailant with respect and consideration, and to focus on what needs to be done. Like, just in that meeting where somebody's undercut you, it's a great idea. So somebody else now owns that idea, but who cares, right? Who cares? I read in another book that Kathy has also read, Kitchen Table Wisdom. One of the little chapters was based on a bumper sticker that you could do a whole lot of good in the world if you can do a whole lot of good in the world if you don't care who gets the credit. So it's a great idea. So now where you go is like, cut the emotionality, do the taking and sending, and let's get on with it. And it's a great idea. So it was my idea. Nobody knows, who cares. Whatever needs to be done. So there's a lot more in this chapter. I'm going to just read the next paragraph. All through this section, meaning the Bodhisattva boot camp, Tokme Zangpo has described how to use unpleasant and painful situations to deepen practice. He means business. His instructions are not pragmatic strategies for managing difficult situations. They are ways to deepen your relationship with life itself by moving into the clear natural awareness that is the essence of human experience. So that might be another antidote to any pride we might feel, is that what we're focusing on is not feeling superior to the other person in some way. We are focusing on waking up. So we are genuinely grateful to them for helping us wake up. We're not holding it against them in any way. We're just appreciative that we're waking up, whatever it takes, whatever slap in the face it takes, we're waking up. So there's more in Ken MacLeod, and if you have the book, I encourage you to read that commentary again and again, if possible, especially those sections. And anybody have anything else they'd like to say before we do our dedication? I don't think I have anything else. So, Deidre, I am unmuting you.
You know what I've been thinking of when we're talking about this is, and I have to probably contemplate it some more this week, is the inequality in women's thoughts to men's thoughts, you know, ideas, presentations, because there's a lot, if I were a Black woman to say something, it's going to have a lot less meaning than if a white man says something, you know, and you could look at that in a lot of different situations. So I think being a married woman, and I have practiced that for a very long time, as I'm sure most women have, to whether it's turn the other cheek or look at yourself and see where the fault really lies, or whatever it is. It just seems to me, just on in that situation, I need to think about it deeper.
Yeah. For certain people, as you're saying, for various reasons. I mean, grinning and bearing it could be just survival for them, because right. They can't make the situation any different.
But does it also allow bad behavior?
I'm sorry, what also allows bad?
Is the passivity allowing more bad behavior?
Yeah.
You know, if it's all on me,
Yeah.
Where does it stop?
Well, the thing is that we can't control another person. You cannot make another person act or think differently than they think. But it doesn't mean being passive. I mean, I think it means recognizing what effect you are actually capable of having and having that effect. And what it means is doing it, like whatever action you need to take, you take it with not in the throes of an emotional reaction, which doesn't help right. you. So we use taking and sending to clarify like our emotionality. And then we take whatever action we need to take. And some people are obviously in a more powerful position to take action that will have an effect than other people are. And I think recognizing what we can do is part of the whole calculus of it, of whatever the situation is. But it's not about passivity, but I think sometimes there's really nothing that one can do, especially say if you are an oppressed person with no power in some situation where really nobody listens to you. It's sometimes there's no point riling the situation up further, even if you do it without emotionality. I mean, I see Rinpoche do that many times, like something bad is happening. And he says, just leave it alone. You know, it's not going to help. Yeah, they're wrong. They're completely wrong. They're doing something that's harmful, but they're not going to listen. And it's only going to make it worse to stir it up more. So we just let it naturally subside. Wisdom, I mean, a lot of wisdom is recognizing where those lines are. So we do our best with them. I mean, that's a great point that you brought up. We just do our best.
I'm saying that I think in a lot of these books and a lot of these things, mm-hmm. something like that is not really addressed. You know, like you're saying, it seems to apply to, it's easy to view the teachings that are coming through these different books in a way that deals with kind of mild situations, but very deeply ingrained habitual cultural problems. You know, it doesn't seem to me to really reach that place. You know, yeah. I mean, I can see it because I've studied for the last 20 years. But if I were looking at this from a new situation, I would say this doesn't really help. You know, it's not telling me how to address it on a cultural level where it's such a huge problem.
Right. Well, I mean, in one sense, I mean, I think that's a really huge question that you're raising. And in one sense, like the cultures were maybe more homogenous that these teachings are coming out of. I can't really speak to that because I don't know. They had a caste system in India. So the Buddhist teachings were not in a context with fewer cultural problems, perhaps. But the most basic teaching, and there's certainly a lot of debate about this right now, is you have to, like, the work is internal. The most important work is if you don't clear your own mind, if you don't develop wisdom, then your compassion is almost useless because you can make mistakes and you can make things worse for people. Or you can just be flailing, wasting your energy, flailing against something that you can't change. It doesn't mean that we don't engage, but it does mean that we don't discount the importance of doing that internal work. Because the more internal work we do, the more clearly we can see how to address bigger questions. All of Buddhism boils down to, and again, you've got to know where the lines are here because it's not literal exactly. All of Buddhism boils down to not trying to be happy by controlling external circumstances, but turning inward and doing the work on your own mind as the way to find actual happiness and peace. And how does that help others is a question that we have to resolve for ourselves. We have to do the internal work or there's no point in the external work. We see through history, you know, it doesn't help. I mean, things get better for a while and then things get worse or worse things come up. It's never problem free. So we can't solve it. We actually can't solve it. We cannot solve samsara. But we can help individually. There's certainly situations where we can have a positive impact. And I think we need to recognize those And the more wisdom we have and the more compassion we have and the more sort of subtle or deep our compassion is, the more we can actually see how to have a positive impact. It's a very, very deep question. Thanks for raising it. I don't think there's an easy answer to it. But I always, the ball that I mostly keep my eye on is not trying to fix samsara because it's not fixable. But knowing that I can intervene in ways that can help individual situations and individual people. And that the clearer my mind is, the less emotionally reactive I am, the more I can help. So the work remains mostly internal, but then you do what you can. I mean, God, if there was an earthquake, you wouldn't be sitting on your meditation cushion. You'd be out there triaging anybody you could triage, digging people out, you know, forget the meditation. But right now, we kind of have the luxury a little bit. There's certainly, we could all go to Syria, you know, and have an impact there. But yeah. Anyway, I can't solve it either.
that's kind of my go-to thing is, why am I trying to fix samsara when I get into those muddles? But one of the other things that's been helpful for me to say is that kind of allows that space is I can say, oh, this is happening now. That's kind of that's been my go-to lately is like, oh, this is happening now.
Yeah, exactly.
Just kind of look at it.
Yeah, exactly. And by defining it, by seeing it clearly, then everything can settle in a way that you can see if there is something that's not going to make things worse.
Great.
So just, you know, we've run a bit over time. I think it's been a good discussion. Always, if we do run over time, and sometimes we will because we're engaged in a conversation, if anybody has to leave, just do your own dedication and go. Does anybody have anything else they'd like to add before we do our dedication? All right, we will dedicate the merit then. I'll find my prayers. Next week we will do, this is the end actually of the individual situations. There's a few more verses in Bodhisattva Boot Camp before we get to ultimate bodhicitta, which is fabulous verses too. The next 2 weeks are just chaos. Everything goes wrong or everything goes right. They're really fun verses, actually. So I hope everybody will be here the next couple weeks. All right. Dedication of merit. All the all sentient beings, may this practice and study and conversation benefit all sentient beings and help all of us awaken. Oops, I gotta meet a couple people. Why not? This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntuzam Ho and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Let's take just a split second to bring our minds to rest again in the present moment, the feeling of being in our body in this seat. In the present moment, connected with everything in the universe.